Hi, I'm Andy Reid.
And I'm Mike Porter.
You're listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations, which is aired on the third Wednesday of each month from 2 until 3 p.m. on WGXE Acre 90.7 FM.
On each show, invited guests will be asked to discuss a number of items that they intend taking with them on their Catskill Cabin getaway. As we discuss their chosen items, it is hoped that you, the listener, will enjoy getting to know that person a little bit better.
Today's guest is Judd Weisberg. Judd was born in Brooklyn, New York. His mum was a music teacher and his dad was a policeman. As a boy growing up in New York City, Judd attended the High School of Music and Art. After high school, he was a student at Carnegie Mellon, where he graduated with a BFA in painting and printmaking. From there, he went on to earn a master's in education at Pratt University. Judd's summers were spent in Lexington at Camp Lexington in the Catskill Mountains, which his parents ran. His love of the Catskills developed there. Consequently, Judd left New York City behind and moved full-time up to the Catskills, where he began building and designing furniture from locally found and harvested wood. He continues to make furniture to this day. You can view Judd's amazing work at www.juddworks.com. Judd has a keen love for fishing and nature, and this has led to him becoming a guide throughout the spring, summer and fall months. His purpose as a guide is to teach the techniques of fishing, but most importantly, respect for the natural world. Judd, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for coming, Judd.
I'm indeed very honored and very great to be here with you boys and share whatever I can with you.
Well, do you have £50 you could borrow? I could borrow.
Canadian.
Well, that's even better.
So, Judd, what do you make of this unusually warm winter?
It's very it has two qualities. One, it allowed me to work outdoors on some special pieces that I'm making for a garden in Onteora Club in Tannersville. I thought I was going to be frozen out way before, and I managed to get one of the two structures done. So I really am very excited about the fact that we had this warm early season, and it was quite beautiful to work outdoors.
Now, what is it you're making?
I'm making a grape arbor and also a fence with an archway that has seats for people to sit. And there's going to be an actual vegetable garden in that area there. The grape arbor is completely created from local cedar, which is actually a juniper family that grows everywhere up here in the Catskills.
And amongst all of the hemlocks.
Well, you know, it's a very interesting wood. It's very, very durable, and it was used for making fences for farmers for many, many years. And so I've been experimenting and playing with it in different ways for many, many years. But it's a great wood to work out for outdoor structures because it just lasts forever.
Now, Judd, normally, you know, when somebody says they're building something, it's kind of like, you know, hammers and nails and, you know, get that wee bit of wood from the store there. It's not like that, is it?
Not at all. It's almost the opposite. You're actually, in my work, I'm looking for things that are not straight lines, that are curves and twisted and show nature's forces.
Yeah, I mean, we've both, Mike and I, have looked at your website, and I have composed a list, I will get to that soon, of the items that I want from from your list, and I want them now! the first one being the Cappy four-poster bed. Now, that fully exemplifies what you're saying, and if anybody wants to see that, they can go onto your website and look at that.
Yes, well, the story about that is very interesting. It's entirely made out of weathered wood, driftwood,
right,
of various species. I collect the stuff everywhere I go, whether it's saltwater, freshwater. But I got started doing it right here in the Catskills.
Do you find that particular areas bear washed up fruit, if you like, more than others, you know, like estuaries and stuff like that?
Well, if you watch the wind patterns, you know, you look at the prevailing winds,
uh-huh.
this stuff piles up in coves.
I mean, it truly is one man's junk, another man's treasure, isn't it? And you,
indeed.
You know, you've literally transformed what some people would consider to be just pieces of wood lying on the floor into a highly desirable piece of furniture, essentially.
When you go driftwood hunting, as I've done all my life,
uh-huh.
you try to figure out what is the essential strength of that piece of wood. Is it weight bearing or is it not weight bearing?
Mm-hmm.
Is it better as a decorative thing that would go, let's say, on a wall or a frame that didn't need to be holding up weight?
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, I might find a very powerful, huge piece that would make a great table base or mm-hmm. a tabletop.
Mm-hmm.
I also don't feel like, you know, that I need to worry about cutting into it and finding out what's inside.
Mm-hmm.
And then using the interior as well as the exterior, which is that gray, typically gray mantle that comes from the weathering process.
Mm-hmm. I was watching a program, and I can't remember what it was, Axemen or something. And I just turned it over. I don't watch the program, essentially, but just turned it over, and there was this part where a woman was looking at this ginormous piece of wood, and she was examining it, and she said, this could be sliced into 5 or 10. I'm talking about pieces the size of this table.
Wow.
And each piece would be worth something like $5,000.
Jeez.
So essentially that big piece of wood that we were looking at was worth about $30,000. And it made me realize, you know, on a grander scale, it's almost like cuts of meat. You know, the grain and the marbling and the
Oh, sure. And there is an art to being a sawyer, learning how to get the most out of a tree,
mm-hmm.
that is what that person was thinking of. Probably was something. If it was on the East Coast, it could have been walnut, and a lot of walnut grows up here in the Catskills, southern Catskills particularly, but. Finding out how to get the spectacular grain structure to show up is done by usually with a bandsaw, a special bandsaw that's on a track.
Yeah, yeah.
And you slice it kind of in a way. You slice it just like cheese, you know.
Right, right.
But those very valuable pieces that that person was telling you about comes from two things. One is the stability of the wood. Does it have a lot of rot in it?
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's been laying on the ground, it's going to turn. It's going to rot.
Mm-hmm.
Water mixed with wood eventually turns it back into soil. So you have to be very, very careful about you know, that which you harvest, because that will allow you to do the kind of thing you want to do. Now, I love I love all the voids and the holes and the knots and the unique parts of the of a slab that might be cut out of that. I don't do that part of it myself. I have a sawyer who can do magic with the big bandsaws, and also he has a big crew, and they sometimes do it with a chainsaw, a two-handed chainsaw, and they make these slabs. And then you need to let them rest. They can't be just used right off of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
You have to let them rest, and if they've got mischief in them, like if they're going to warp and they're going to bow and they're going to crack, why then you've got to let them do that, and then you select from the
remains or whatever, what it's turned out to be.
Well, exactly. In other words, the tree itself, when you slice it with the grain, it's what we call a flitch. That's a series of slabs in order, you know. And then when you do that, you put little spacers in to allow the air to dry it, to start the drying process. And then a year or two later, if you know, if you're so moved, you can take them and put them in a very big kiln and get them to about 10% moisture, which is then a good interior moisture level to work with. And all the wood that you use, if you're going to glue it, has to be of the same moisture content. So it's important to really you know, do your homework that way and test frequently and make sure that you're keeping the moisture content. If you're going to do any gluing, sometimes I don't do gluing. Sometimes I do. I join other ways. You know, I use hardware. I use dowels. I create sculptural elements that are part of the joinery process.
Have you ever been in a situation where you went, "Oh, this is too difficult. Let's just go and buy something from IKEA." Now, we need to move on. We need to move on for in order, because we'll get back to talking about wood, because I'm really interested in it, and I've got some stuff that I think Mike and I have seen online we want to talk about.
Sure.
Judd, you were mentioning that you were able to find this wood by paying attention to the wind and looking at, in coves, and it's interesting that your first song is called Windy Old Weather, and we've had some wind this year. I don't know if I'd characterize the weather as old. It seems pretty new, pretty young weather. New, weird, non-traditional climate up here in upstate New York.
I agree. It's a little spooky.
Yeah.
It's a little spooky because we hear so much about, you know, the changing in weather and, you know, and we worry about global warming and so on. But these sort of warm winters have happened many, many times in the past.
Could it be that because the last two or three winters have been severely cold, that we think it's warm, but it's you know, if we had had slightly milder weather winters in the last two or three months, we wouldn't be viewing this weather with as an extreme?
I think you're right. I think you need to look at the long view. You know, you need to look at the. It's good to really talk with. I would listen to someone who is a weather expert to really get a sense of context, of you know where this stands in relation to history. I am you know, very avid in my feelings about global warming. I feel that that anything that humans can do to arrest this sinister development, we should do, but we may not be able to do. And it's not all caused by man. It's caused by natural cycles. So you get a 1-2 punch. Some things happen because man abuses nature, and other natural cycles take place.
Well, things like volcanoes and stuff like that.
Sure. Exactly.
Yeah.
So... But anyway, that song, Mike, what's it called?
Windy Old Weather.
What about that song is, why do you want to take this to the cabin with you, Judd?
First of all, I love the sound of the voices of the people singing it. And it's a fisherman's song. Now, these guys are commercial fishermen, singing a shanty for their amusement, and because the fact is that it's a brutal occupation to get out in the winter or any kind of windy conditions and try to haul in a load of fish.
Well, there's two types of fishermen, isn't there? There's the guys who stand at the side of the river with their net and their rod, and there's also the guys who go out and they trawl for fish.
Exactly.
So is that what you're talking about, the trawlers?
Yes. Yeah. These are the commercial fishers. These are the professional fishers that harvest.
The guys that help get your fish on the plate in the restaurant.
Exactly.
Right.
The ones that many of the others are mostly releasing their catch or very limiting their kill. and it's done as a way of protecting the wild stock in the river. You know, and we can tell the difference because you can see the state marks the fish that they stock in the streams by clipping a fin off. And when you see a beautiful trout that has no clipped fins, it's a wild one. And we especially want to protect those because we want to increase the number of wild fish in our trout streams up here in the Catskills.
Shall we listen to the song?
Yes.
Great.
As we were fishing off Haysborough Light, shooting and hauling and trawling all night. In that windy old weather, stormy old weather, when the wind blows, it all pulled together. When up jumped a herring, the queen of the sea, says, "Now, old skipper, you cannot catch me." In the windy old weather, stormy old weather, when the wind blows, we'll all pull together. We sighted a thrasher, a slash in his tail. Time now, old skipper, to hoist up your sail. In the windy old weather, stormy old weather, when the wind blows, we'll all pull together. Then up jumps a slipsail as strong as a horse. Says now, old skipper, you're miles off course. In the windy old weather, stormy old weather, when the wind blows, we'll all pull together. Then along comes a place who's got spots on his side. Says not much longer, these seas you can ride. In the windy old weather, stormy old weather, when the wind blows, we'll all pull together. Then up rears a conger as long as a mile. Winds come in easterly, he says with a smile. In the windy old weather, stormy old weather, when the wind blows, we'll all pull together. I think what that these fishes are saying is right. We'll haul up our gear now and steer for the light. In the windy old weather, stormy old weather, when the wind blows, we'll all pull together.
That was Windy Old Weather. A song that's used for the theme tune, I believe, for Assassin's Creed.
It's from the Assassin's Creed video game, that's correct.
Creed, yeah. And we were just saying, while we were listening to that there, I just get this sudden urge to be holding a big pint of beer and swaying along with the music. It's great, isn't it? in a bar or in a pub down in southern England somewhere, you know? Fantastic.
Your next item, Judd, is a carved fish, and on the back is the Angler's Anthem. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the Angler's Anthem was written by a dearly departed friend, Frank Maley, who wrote this. He was a musician and a teacher, but he loved to fly fish, and he wrote this Angler's Anthem. Actually, it was in celebration for a great win that we had getting some control of the releases from the reservoirs, which we actually continue to have today, to give the trout a fighting chance downstream, because most of the summer heat would fry the fish or poach them. But this is releasing cold water whenever it's possible. When I say ever possible, it's, you know, water supply is the primary issue.
Yeah.
And they need to reach certain critical targets to enable the water supply to be, you know, to be met. And also there's some power generation issues further downstream. So, but he wrote this as a celebratory thing, but it's also a kind of poetic kind of a feeling that comes through about the wonderful feeling that we all get as fly fishermen when we go to the river.
Right. That's what I was going to ask. How did you come by it? You know, obviously it means a lot to you. Still got it.
And I you know, when we sang it, it was sung at a celebration party, and for that bit of regulation that we got through. And it was sung mostly by fishermen, and some of them are pretty famous fishermen.
Right. Well, you.
Well, I wasn't so. I'm not that famous, but people like Art Flick, who's the local character, who wrote a lot about flies and fish in the Catskills, and several other people were in the group, and some of Frank Malley's students played on their instruments while we sang.
Now you're going to sing this song later on in the show, aren't you?
I'd be happy to if everyone can forgive my sharp and flat problems that I have.
Well, that's I'll have to reserve judgment until the end. But that's great. I mean, I'm looking at it right now, and it obviously means a lot to you because A, you've brought it here, and you know there's obviously sentimental value in terms of the memories that it provokes for you.
It absolutely does. It describes the secret world of the trout that we're all impassioned about. It talks about a kind of the magic of their environment that we're so attracted to.
Now, in terms of, you know, fishing, what does fly fishing mean to you?
That's a great question because it means so many different things. But first of all, it is a way of connecting to the natural world that surrounds the stream, as well as the stream itself, and then the fish. And by learning what the fish eat, when they eat it, why they eat it, and how you can create a fly, which is actually a lure, that simulates what they eat. If you do it in a convincing manner, you'll catch a fish.
Well, you know, we had a guest on a while back, and Mike did some research on the different types of nymphs and stages flies. Of flies. And I didn't realize any of this. Obviously, you do know this. So what you're saying there, the critical thing is knowing what type of fly or lure, pardon my naivety, what to make and what to use on a particular time of day, evening, and weather conditions and stuff like that.
Exactly. Water flow has a lot to do with it. The current, whether it's a still water, whether it's a fast-moving piece of water, trout and other game fish in the Catskills feed on insects, and the magic of that world is so absorbing. You get to see the nymphs, as you were mentioning before, which is the immature larval stages, develop, and then all of a sudden, like magic, they come to the surface, and they're on the surface, and they're fluttering around, and the fish are eating them on their way up while they're hatching, while they're trying to dry their wings. They're looking for their feeding, and the more of these flies that are there, the more wild and exciting the day becomes because the fish are jumping all over the place trying to get them. And that's that's what we call a hatch. And the hatch is one of those magical things that happens exactly when it's supposed to happen. The water temperature has to be perfect. The time of year has to be right. And it has to be in the right part of the stream. Different bugs live in different places.
Now, going back to what Mike was saying about the weather, is this weather going to play havoc on when you know when the right time is for particular types of fishing? Because are the animals and the insects going to be fooled thinking that it's spring?
No, I don't think so. I think what will happen is the fish will actually get a chance to feed in the wintertime when they normally would be more
docile.
They would actually almost be very, very quiet. And they will feed in cold weather, as long as there's something to eat, they'll come and get it. And you know, I don't know if you've noticed, when the sap buckets start to come out and people are tapping maple trees,
yeah,
there are little black flies that are often floating around over the sap buckets, and also on the snow they're crawling around. Well, those are, in some cases, from the stream, and they've hatched, and the fish are eating them when they can. They're not as active at that point, but they will feed. And for a couple of moments during the day when the water temperature is at its peak, the trout will be feeding on those little bugs. We call them snow flies.
What's the biggest fish you've caught?
Ever?
No lying, no.
You mean in the Catskills?
No, yeah, anyway. Let's start with the Catskills and then see what this goes.
All right. Well, some years ago, in a place...
Here we go. Some years ago.
Many years ago, there are two lakes up very near to
this better be good, by the way.
Yeah, there's a one called Capra Lake.
Do you know it, Mike?
No,
and
no.
It's a private lake. And then below there is Colgate Lake, which is a public area where people swim during the summertime.
The proletariat go there. You were in the upper class lake.
I weaseled my way into
weaseled his way. Who did you know? Knew the local judge or something?
I had heard. From a friend who was good friends with the caretaker there, that there were some monsters.
Were you trespassing?
No, I got permission. Because, to make a long story short, I was working for the Boys Clubs of America doing an after-school program. Right. And the Boys Clubs had jurisdiction up there. And when I learned about those big trout, I formulated my plan to appeal to them. And they didn't want to do it, and they didn't want to do it, and they finally said, all right, look, you get there before daylight, and you get out of there when you hear the first announcement on the public address system for everybody to assemble. We don't want you mingling with any of the kids. You know, we want you to be on your way. And so I showed up. And it was in the middle of August, the dark of the moon, and there was a storm. And it was windy old weather in the extreme.
There's a windy old weather.
Oh, yeah. It was blowing. Stormy old weather. And when the wind blows, we all cast together, you see. I took with me a very, very dear friend, an old fisherman who tied his own flies, and the two of us.
Yeah.
I put my car topper, my little boat on the top of my car, and we put in at the outlet of the stream, of the
private lake.
This lake, and we rode in the stormy old weather. We rode and rode all the way up to where the stream came out of the mountain. Now this lake was filled with wild native brook trout, which were the trout that were here before we got here, and you know what they did, you know, when they come out of the hillside, went down in that lake and said, "Oh my God, this is so full of food. I'm staying here. You know, I'm not going back up there where you get an occasional beetle or an ant. You know, when we can." You know, eat minnows and crayfish and
all. This was the promised land.
They've come to the promised land. Well, we arrived there, and then in this storm came. There was a quiet moment, and we started to see all kinds of fish rising because there was something that they were going after. My little fly computer was going overtime, and it was about to crash, and then suddenly I saw what they were taking. And I told my friend, I've got an imitation of it. We're going to start catching some fish. And we did. We got some beauties. And then all of a sudden, I started to hear that gut-wrenching sound of the public address trip.
Oh, no.
So I said, all right, George, one more cast apiece. They're not really
we're stretching the boundaries of what we should be doing.
We were really stretching it. So we each took a cast, and the cast settled to the bottom, and I crept that fly across the bottom very slowly, and damn, I felt like I just hooked a log. But guess what? It was not a log. It was the biggest fish I ever caught in the Catskills. It was a 5.5-pound brook trout, and that's a monster in the Catskills. The fish took off like a freight train. I got it in, and ran back out a second time, and it was about 27 inches long, and it had a big wide girth. It had eaten a lot of its less fortunate neighbors and all the bugs it could possibly get. And that was the big fish. And I netted it, and I did not release it because I thought that was going to be a fish I'm going to take home. And George and his family and I were going to have it for dinner, which we did. But before I did, I went to one of my mentors, who was Art Flick, to show him the fish. And his eyes popped out. He said, "Where did you get that?" I'm sworn to secrecy, sir.
Fantastic. Yep.
Now, did you smoke it? Did you fry it up?
We baked it and stuffed it with crab meat and cashew nuts. I like to cook, so.
You're making me hungry.
Oh, good
here.
Grief, yeah.
And then we opened up a nice chilled bottle of Vouvray to go with it. Whenever it comes to big trout, you'll find me there, whether they've got a pedigree or they're wild.
So you can be trusted for anything, but if your head's turned by a trout, then what you were trusted for is meaningless.
Exactly.
Wow. Now, you had mentioned, Judd, also crawfish. Is that something that a trout would eat?
Oh, boy, do they love crawfish. Mm. And big ones, too. I've got plenty of crawfish stories.
Yeah. Well, your next song is the Crawdad Song.
Oh, very great.
And what tell us about that.
Well, it's just a, first of all, those of you who know Andy Griffith, and he used to take Opie fishing, and they actually went fishing for crawdads, which is an edible, they're edible size. They're like little lobsters.
Yeah.
And down south, they're a delicacy. But I just loved. I used to love the Andy Griffith Show. That's where I first saw that, and I always think of it with great sentimental. I'm a real sentimentalist. However, big fish love crawdads, so that's the second. That's the second part of the story, and I've caught some very large trout with pieces of the biggest crawdads I've ever seen in the Catskills. They'll crush them, kind of the way we eat lobster. You know, you break them up, but they do it with their teeth, and they take out all the goodies that are inside under the shell. Only it's raw. It's like
raw crawdad.
It's raw crawdad.
Cry, honey, baby mine. when you lose your pole, honey? What you gonna do when you lose your pole, babe? What you gonna do when you lose your pole? Just sit and look down that crawdad hole, honey, baby mine. Get up, Kate, you slept too late, honey. Get up, Kate, you slept too late, babe. Yes, get up, Kate, you slept too late. Crawdad man done passed your gate, honey, baby mine.
You're listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations on WGXC ACRA, that's 90.7 FM. Today on the show, we have Judd Weisberg, and that was the Crawdad song by with Andy Griffiths. There's part two to the fishing story that we still need to hear, and that is, Judd, what was the biggest fish that you have ever caught?
The biggest fish I ever caught was down in the Bahamas. And it was a yellowtail tuna of about 77 pounds. It was not caught on a fly, though.
77 pounds?
Yeah.
Wow.
Not on a fly rod.
Not on a fly rod.
Snap. Were you using a crane?
We were trolling, you know, big lures, you know, that skipped along in the wake of the boat. And these monsters would come up and just hammer them. But I've had some really fun.
Did you fry it up?
Yes. We brought it back to the place we were staying, and they put it on the grill, and it was exquisite. We also had it as sashimi. It was delicious.
Probably ate it for the next year.
Yeah, boy, well, sounds like it was great.
It was great, and the captain gave all the other fish that we caught to the kitchen, and they cooked them up for the guests at the place. It was part of the deal. I mean, what were we going to do? Bring them all the way back up to the Catskills? Yeah. I don't think so.
I mean, in all seriousness, how do you bring in a 77-pound fish?
With great difficulty. It's teamwork between you and the boat. You know, you have to have a good captain that keeps the pressure on the fish, knows when to back down so that you don't snap the line. Because if you just, you know, if you just keep the gunning the engine, you'll just rip the thing out of his mouth. But that particular one was one of several, and I think Pam got one bigger than that.
Pam being your wife.
Pam being my loving wife. And
did she hook it and lean over and say, "We're going to need a bigger boat"? I said, okay, I'm good, thank you.
Now, you have with you, and you brought with you, and you looked fantastic, I have to say, as you walked in the front door with your homemade fly rod and your homemade landing net. Can you tell us about them?
The landing net is a very critical part of catching fish from either wading or from the boat. The one I brought in is actually one that I used on my boat because it has an extra long handle. You want to, if you're not going to keep the fish, you want to treat them with as little handling as you can. So these big nets allow the fish to swim around, and then you can unhook the fly and then just give them a little bit of reoxygenation and then let them go when they're ready. And that's what that big hoop is for.
Can I ask, sorry to interrupt you, but
yeah,
what makes you decide whether to keep a fish or to let a fish go?
Well, if a fish is looks like he's bleeding, you do everything you can to hopefully, if you're into catch and release, to avoid that.
What does bleeding mean?
Well, if he takes the hook deep enough into his gills, it's probably not going to survive. And if he doesn't survive, you can either leave the fish there for the eagles to eat, or you can take him home and eat him.
Fry him up.
Yep. Mm. And that's when I usually take home a fish. But I usually take, when I take one, I usually take a big one, because one fish feeds two or three people.
Right.
Sure.
However, I might also add that in the Catskill Mountains, in a lot of these small streams, there are tiny brook trout that have been here since the dawn of time, and they are delicious, but they're very small, and they never will grow very big, so it's okay to take a few of them because they're very numerous. I sort of have to weigh that, whether the population is endangered and needs help.
Needs time to regenerate.
To regenerate. And I usually don't, if I'm going to keep one for eating, I don't like to keep the really, really big ones. I'll keep a big one, but not a monster. The big monsters, I let go. If I feel that they're over 18 inches, they've done most of the spawning they're going to do. So over 18, I still let them go because it's fun for somebody else to catch them. And being a guide, I know where that fish came from and I know how to find him again usually, because most people now are releasing most of those big trophy fish so other fishermen can have the fun of catching and releasing.
Right. Now, you brought with you the rod in a case.
Yes.
Did you make that rod?
I did. I used to make a lot of my own rods.
How hard is it to make a rod?
Well, it's not that hard. All you need is a Bible, a teacup, and a spool of thread. I'm not kidding you. You can also
this is a MacGyver project, or
you could also use Webster's Dictionary instead of the Bible.
Right. So a thick book,
so you can run the thread through, and it creates just enough tension so that you can wrap on to the rod, which comes as a blank, those little guides that allow the line to be in parallel to the rod,
right,
and make it cast properly. And I used to make a lot of rods for all purposes, for salt water, for fresh water. When Pam and I went to Alaska, I made two pack rods, which we could put in our backpacks.
Mm-hmm.
And we caught some pretty big fish with those rods.
Yeah. Was it private lakes?
No. This is all
trespassing.
It's no. It was not. It's if you can get there, you can fish there. It's open water.
Right.
However, we did fish. We went to some pretty amazing spots.
Now, have you or have you not, Judd, been to Scotland?
I have, and I loved it very much there. The people were so great there. In fact, a fellow guide gave me as a gift, his name is George Purvis, gave me a gift of a waiting staff that he had made. And I don't use it, I just like to keep it,
Yeah.
But I think that the place where I went was the Tweed River, and its tidal.
Yeah.
And we, through a very fortunate circumstance, we got permission to fish the last of the what they call beats before it becomes truly tidal. It's just above the tide line.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what happens is, both trout and salmon come in there, and there's also grayling in the upper part. So the fish, it was low water conditions, and the fish were in there, but they were not being very cooperative. And so one morning I got up very early and I took a very long rod, which is the way that they fish there. It's a two-handed rod. And I went all the way up to what was an old castle, and it had a beautiful, weedy, braided area where the stream came in and kind of worked its way through and then went back down and went into a riffle down below. And I put on a local pattern, a fly pattern, which imitates a little shrimp, and made a cast. And lo and behold, I hooked a sea trout. They call them suin over there, too. That's the other word. But this the sea trout is actually considered the real treasure. If you get them, the salmon is such a pain in the neck to catch that you're more likely to catch a sea trout than a salmon. But anyway, they told me if I did get one to keep it, which I did. It was about a pound and a half long. And on my way back to there was a little stone hut that we were allowed to use called a bothy.
Bothy, yeah.
And so
they call it in Scotland, I think, something they call it a button bin.
A button bin?
Mm. Yeah.
Ah.
But they do call them bothies as well.
A bothy. Well, we had the use of that, and I brought the fish back there, and the whole idea was to eat it. But on my way back, there were some redoubtable old gentlemen wearing heavily waxed coats, you know, that to keep the weather off, and they saw this Yankee coming back down there with a fairly decent trout over one finger, and if looks could kill, they would have killed me.
So they'd certainly took umbrage to you catching this fish.
Oh, I don't think they took. I think they were just shocked because people go there and they fish for salmon, and the salmon is a fish of 1,000 casts. But you have to put in those 1,000 casts because number 1,001 or 1,002, you might get that fish.
Right,
and it's happened to me, and these are things that I will never forget as long as I live, because catching the king of the sea, the silver king, is the ultimate fish to catch because it's both saltwater and a freshwater fish.
That's a wonderful story.
Yeah.
And the fact that it happened in Scotland makes it sound even more authentic and beautiful.
Oh, it was
amongst
wonderful.
The heather and the button bin in the background, the castle on the hill.
Oh, it was sensational.
The wee Scottish guy, angry that you caught it.
Well, we ate lunch in the bothy, and the gillie, that's what they call their guides over there, had made lunch for us. And it was...
Haggis?
No, it was not haggis. We had that later. But it was a special cheese, very stinky.
It's probably off.
and Plowman's pickle.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
And I don't remember the name of that cheese, but if you mention a couple of well-known ripe cheeses, it wasn't Limburger, but it wasn't that bad. It just had a very rich...
So it was a Plowman's lunch.
It was a Plowman's lunch that we had for lunch.
Right.
Hmm.
And we had... We had a wonderful time, and the guide, who I became friendly with, George Purvis, said, "Do you have any places we could guide over there in the U.S.?" I said, "You get over here, man, and I'll find you some work," and because I do that sometimes, you know, get people set up.
Yeah.
But I think he's doing well over there. I liked their attitude, you know, the long suffering attitude, because you can go out there and fish your ass off. Did I say something
bad?
Don't worry. Delete. and the trout, the salmon jump out of the water sometimes right in your face and cover you with spray, just to torment you. And you can cast and cast and cast, and you'll not get them when they do that.
I'd end up jumping in and trying grabbing it with my hands.
With a spear.
You're coming with me one way or another, little friend.
Have you ever done that, Judd? Have you ever done the art of tickling?
No.
I've heard people tickling, the fish. Is that?
Or noodling or whatever.
Well, they do that in different parts of the U.S. It's strictly illegal here in the Catskills to do that.
And that's for usually catfish, right?
The noodling is with catfish.
Yeah.
They stick their hands in.
You tickle the trout.
Oh, okay.
And it kind of relaxes, and then you just scoop it out of the water.
Yeah.
Anyway, we need to move along. We've got two more songs of yours to be. And we could talk about this all night. It's a typical Angler's Tales we're listening to here. But we've got a couple of more songs we need to play.
Your next song is Quando Ritrovo la Mia Pastorella, and this is by Costanzo Festa. Why this particular song, Judd?
Well, Pam and I both love this, and a few years ago, I will not divulge how many years ago, we could actually sing it on tune, but there was a wonderful musician, that kind of a roving musician that came around and organized a singing group, and we sung madrigals, and this is a madrigal, actually.
That was Quando Ritrovo La Mia Pastorella by Frederick Rents. You're listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations on WGXC Acra. Today we have Judd Weisberg with us. Judd, thanks again for being here.
My pleasure.
We're going to have to wrap it up soon, but we have one more song, and you will be singing it for us.
I will do my best.
Briefly before that, you are bringing with you to the Catskill Cabin a fly tying kit.
Yes.
Obviously, you need to be able to tie the flies in order to use the rod and the net that you brought.
Correct.
Or that would have rendered them worthless. Are you good at making flies?
I am.
You are?
Nice. I like it. Confidence.
Yeah, that was a without confident hesitation. Air about your voice there.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie to you.
He's not gonna lie about the fly.
I tie a good fly.
You don't catch a 5-pound trout by, you know, tossing any hook and worm.
You might, but to catch them on one of my home tied flies is a special treat.
Hmm. How long does it take to make one fly?
Depends on the pattern. Right, sometimes as little as 2 minutes. Sometimes it takes me 20 minutes to make one, depending on how many elements there are.
Right. Hmm. Well, I thought you were going to say a couple of days.
Yeah.
So as short as 20 minutes?
As short as a minute or two, and a real professional contract tire can whip them off like you can't believe.
Wow.
But I never do that. I tie a few, and that's my limit. And they're usually about 5 to 15 minutes.
Now, me and Mike have been eagerly waiting on this. You're going to sing a song for us.
Okay.
Can you briefly describe what the song is and why you want to sing it?
Well, in very few words, it talks about the beauty of the trout's world and why we love it so much. And so it's a celebration of the beautiful environment the trout live in. And I'm going to sing it now. It's the Angler's Anthem by Frank Melle.
Now, is it the words that are on the fish ornament that you were talking about earlier?
Yes.
Okay.
I inscribed the back of the ornament with these words. Oh, sing of nature's bounty, of the glory of the stream, where riffles chant their mystery, two pools a-dimpling in a dream. Go softly, softly to the river, where trout glide in shadowed ecstasy. 'Tis there that I would linger unto eternity. 'Tis there that I would linger unto eternity.
Superb, mate.
Thank you very much,
that
Judd.
That was excellent, mate.
I recognize that. Is that tune used with other lyrics and other songs? Was it?
It's based on the music of Schubert's Trout Quintet.
Oh, superb! Well, that works perfectly well.
it was condensed and there's a little bit of a mashup in there.
And your lyrics were fine. You obviously had some honey today.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And the tea, your tea was a perfect. I become a kind of a chai. I like chai. That's a good thing. That loosened up the ailing.
Now, Judd, we're going to be finishing here very, very soon.
Good.
It's been a pleasure listening to your stories. It truly has. I've really enjoyed. It's given me a thirst for getting back into the Catskill Mountains again. Yeah. And I will be finding that pond,
that hidden pond.
That's part of the beauty of it, really, is searching for these secret spots.
Yeah.
And, if you play your cards right, if you're willing to wake up early enough, you can accompany me sometime to one of my private spots.
Judd, I
was going to ask you before we wrap it up. What about Echo Lake and Alder Lake? Are you familiar with those?
We are. I want to say Pam and I have camped out on Alder. Those are they have little wild brook trout in there, and I think some bigger ones as well. They were estates, I think, that were given to New York State, and you're allowed to fish there. It is, they're open to the public. You can also camp on one or the other of the two of them. There's little unimproved campsites. They're beautiful, beautiful lakes.
Yeah.
You've been there, haven't you, Mike?
I've stayed there, yeah. I was at Alder Lake last summer. I haven't fished, but I've heard that the fishing is pretty excellent. So I think I'm going to have to try that sometime.
Yeah. I think me and Mike will take you up on the private and well-trained knowledge that you have of where to go for these private little secret trout fishing holes.
Yeah.
Judd, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you. It's a pleasure being with both of you and sharing some of these stories. All the stories I told are absolutely true with no exaggeration. Oh, well, maybe a little.
Judd, we have just one more question for you.
Yes.
How do you take your coffee?
Black.
Black. Strong?
Strong.
You're some man. It's just the same as me.
Hi, I'm Judd Weisberg, and you've been listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations on WGXC Acra, 90.7 FM. Special thanks to George, Gordon, and Billy from the band White for the theme music, and to everyone at WGXC. Thanks.